From the West Australian, I'm Ben O'Shea and this is The West Live.
The West Live.
The West Live
with Ben O'Shea.
I don't blame anyone who finds the minutiae of politics a little dull. Most of the time, it's all legislation this and question without notice that. It's not exactly Fast and the Furious level action. But if you like action, it's worth keeping an eye on the Perth Magistrates Court today for the latest instalment of a blockbuster WA political scandal. This scandal involved Japanese strip clubs, allegations of destroying evidence, and a bombshell investigation by the Corruption and Crime Commission in 2019. It has everything you'd hope for in a Hollywood thriller, and it's happening right here in WA politics. Brian Ellis, the former MLC for the agricultural region, is due to appear in court today, facing four charges, including obstructing the Triple C and destroying evidence. He's the second MP to front court over this matter after old mate Phil Edmund was charged earlier this year. Now, both men have denied the allegations and are entitled to the presumption of innocence, but gosh, it'll be interesting to watch them try and prove it. One of the more colourful allegations made by the Triple C was that Edmund and Ellis told the corruption watchdog that they had conducted an inspection of the supermarket and retail industry in the Japanese town of Kamakura. The Triple C report included, though, that the blokes had instead spent the day in a brothel. Ellis reckoned nothing dodgy happened, though. He had just had, and I quote, a perfectly conventional back massage. So, yeah, if that sort of detail doesn't get you tuning in to this incredible political scandal, I don't know what will. Coming up on the show, is COVID over? And we'll unpack a new platform for victims of sexual harassment to report it anonymously. But first, let's see what's making news.
The West Live. Making news.
And joining me now is Sunrise correspondent Matt Tenney. G'day, mate.
G'day, mate. Happy hump day.
How cold was it this morning?
Oof, so chilly. Well, yesterday was our coldest day of the year.
It was
12.4
freezing.
12.4 degrees, the top, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
It is
very chilly this
cold.
Morning.
Cold. Yesterday, going after the show, going to get my coffee, I was standing outside waiting for it, and I could feel my fingers were hurting.
Really?
And I was like, you know what? You know it's cold. It was cold this morning. It was quite frosty.
Our colleague Cyan Valance sent me a photo because I said, you know, rug up if you're going outside to go for a walk exercise, and she's at the gym. She's like, it's too cold for anything outside.
Yeah. Oh, you'd have to be in the gym this morning. Like, it's absolutely freezing. And I wonder how cold it would be if you're one of the workers who end up at the Bullsbrook former COVID facility that's kind of been sitting gathering dust after the Commonwealth government built it. Maybe cost $400 million, I think, 500-bed facility. But now the state government might have found a use for it.
Yes. So it looks like interstate and overseas workers and their families are going to live there as a short-term arrangement.
Oh, yeah.
So the Department of Training and Workforce Development has come up with this idea whereby these workers and their families would live there for, say, 12 weeks before they find more permanent accommodation. So now what they're doing is they're going to go out to employers in sectors that are suffering from this crippling workforce shortage to get their feedback about this idea and how it could work. And yeah, maybe it will kill two birds with the one stone. We'll have a use for this facility that we spent millions upon millions on, and we'll also improve our worker shortage situation.
Yeah, well, you know what? It's been coming for a while. Let's take a listen to back in sort of the end of June when we had Premier McGowan on the show. Would it be possible to do something a bit out of the box, like use the COVID quarantine facility in Bullsbrook?
That is one of the options we're looking at. Now, that was built by the Commonwealth. We didn't build it, but we will get to operate it for at least a year. And those sorts of things are the sorts of opportunities we're looking at. It's going to have 500 beds, so it's an opportunity for that. How it'll work and that sort of thing is the analysis is currently going on.
So there you go.
Well, you heard it here first.
Heard it
on
here
the West
first
Live.
On the West Live. And so we'll wait and see. Like, I don't think it'd be totally amazing.
No, well,
place to live, but
you know what?
They've got TVs,
internet, kitchenette, microwave, oven, bar fridge, ensuite bathroom, and a
workers,
small balcony.
You know,
it's probably better than the accommodation when they eventually get out of there.
Yeah. Well, you'd think also way cheaper than trying to find a rental in Perth
totally.
At the moment. So I think, you know, we'll wait and see, right? You got to get the workers first.
Yeah.
See if that trip to Ireland Poland, if any of those advertising campaigns that the state government has dropped a few million dollars on, if they come over here, we'll wait and see. And now we're going to talk to our epidemiologist on the show, not me, the actual epidemiologist, James Trower, a bit later on. And we're going to ask him if COVID is over, because it does seem as though maybe the pandemic is kind of winding back.
Yeah, and it seems like the experts are now joining the rest of us in wanting it to be be over. I think that's the change. But we're going to see from Monday a shift in our hospitals whereby the COVID rules are going to be wound back. So this will make it easier to visit people in hospital. It will also make it easier for staff. They'll be wearing less PPE, the frontline staff members. In terms of visitation, there was a lot of staff hours and headcounts being used up, checking that people were vaccinated. Effectively, now it's going to become an honesty policy. There'll be, you know, spot checks. But those staff who were put on to checking people will now be able to go and do what they do, which is helping improve the health of people, which is probably a good situation given the situation in our health system and how difficult things have been of late. We can use every hand on deck.
But you know what the flip side of that is? What has been the government's number one excuse to explain away problems in the health system over the past 2 years?
Or COVID.
COVID.
Yeah, well,
so COVID protocols taking up so much time, taking up so much resources. That's why there's ramping. That's why, you know, there are these poor
won't
outcomes.
Won't be an excuse anymore.
Exactly. So it's going to be fascinating to see now what impact winding back some of those COVID protocols will have, if they were indeed the big impediment that the government has been saying that they have been over the past 2 years, or if not. I guess we'll wait and see.
I mean, this is the thing. We're 2022 now.
Yeah, we've got to move on.
We've got to move on. We can't be in this state of emergency for years and years and years and years.
I'll admit, I was a bit wary of, you know, sort of moving forward.
Oh, you've too been very
quickly.
Conservative.
Yeah, well, because, you
as
know,
the
like.
Self-appointed epidemiologist. Yeah.
Well, I put my faith in the modelling.
But the modelling's been, as Mark McGowan says, the modelling's always wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, we did expect a second wave of Omicron infections that were going to top 10,000 daily infections. Didn't happen.
No.
But I base a lot of my modelling, personal modelling, on anecdotal evidence.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that
just
neither
like a
of
trip
us.
To Woolies
well,
at the
do you remember? Do you remember going back like a few weeks when we were kind of at the sort of 8 weeks post COVID infection the first time around, and we were going, okay, we're going to get it again. We're going to get reinfected.
We were sure we were.
But we have not.
Oh, God.
Why? So, but that's what I'm saying, though, you know? Like,
luckily,
I don't think,
on this desk panel, there's a bit of wood. I'm just going to touch
WA,
it for us.
I think WA has proved that it's a bit unique again, a bit different to everywhere else.
Have you had your fourth jab?
No, I haven't had it yet.
No, see, I was over in Melbourne, remember, that other weekend.
And I was sure you were going to get it.
I was sure I was going to get it, too. I was at a wedding with 300 people. And they were at their peak at that moment when I was there of their winter Omicron wave. No, didn't get it.
Well, we're going to try and find out why that second
really
wave didn't eventuate.
This wood because,
when we
know,
talk
imagine,
to
you
James
know what
Trower
tomorrow, we'll both test bloody positive.
And now, for the last couple of days this week, we've been talking about this fiery crash in Hillary's that involved a dirt bike and a Toyota Kluger, and the Kluger bizarrely had flipped, caught on fire, ended up just being a charred mess of metal, and people landed in hospital. We're slowly starting to paint a picture of what has actually happened in this incident.
Yeah, this explanation is very being drawn out, isn't it, as we try to piece together what's happened. So at the moment, what we know is a 17-year-old who's stable in hospital has been charged over this burglary and vehicle theft crime spree, which is in relation to this whole incident. The 18-year-old who was on the motorbike with him is still fighting for life in Royal Perth Hospital, and the driver of the Kluger is in hospital under police guard. So police are still trying to work out whether these vehicles, the Kluger and the dirt bike, actually collided. But what they're, you know, investigating here is whether it was some sort of revenge action, this crash, for the bikes being stolen. So police are still unravelling this one, but slowly but surely they're getting there. Obviously, they've charged the 17-year-old and they're investigating further. The woman's still under police guard, so many more questions to come on this one.
Lots still to unravel when it comes to this, but based on what we are hearing now from police, do you know what it reminds me of a lot? It reminds me of that incident in Kalgoorlie in 2016 of the young Indigenous boy who had taken a motorbike and had been chased by a fellow and had been actually been run over in the guy's pursuit to get his motorbike back. If that's kind of how things have unfolded in this case, it's like you got to ask yourself, like, what is a motorbike worth? You know what I mean? Like, is it worth a person's life? Is it worth your own life? You have to question that. But I guess, you know, the only way we'll know more is when police complete their investigation and release that information. Yeah. And now this has been every now and then a story comes along and it's, you know, a buffhead criminal. And we've already spoken about these type of cases where you go, do you know what? We've got to make a note of this one and put it on the highlights reel for the end of the year. And this
two things on the board for this week.
So what was the other one? I don't remember it. But it was
Monday.
Yeah. Mel, do you know, Mel, do you remember? You're supposed to be noting this down.
It's ages ago.
And so it was this guy who was on the, doing a runner from the cops. And he wasn't just running from the cops. He was running from a herd of cows.
Yeah, so he's tried to escape after this police pursuit. And he's run into a paddock and then been faced by this herd of huge cows, freaked out, turned the other way and straight into the path of officers who arrested him. So now we have an update on this, just another excuse to run the cow vision, basically. So a 34-year-old man from White Gum Valley has been charged with, run through it, reckless driving to escape pursuit by police, possibly to escape pursuit by cows as well. Driver of a vehicle failed to comply with a direction to stop. No authority to drive, so never had a license. Drove, caused or permitted a vehicle with a forged replica or false plate to be driven on a road. Possession of stolen or unlawfully obtained property and also obstructing police officers. So quite the string of charges there. He's going to appear before Fremantle Magistrates Court on 16th of September. So I'm sure that vision will be played out in court.
And guess what sort of car he was driving?
Oh, is it a Commodore?
Yeah. Holden Senator. I tell you, like, you can almost guarantee that anyone driving any kind of high-powered Commodore, up to no good.
Yeah, if your kids want to buy one of those, steer them away from it.
Yeah. And so let's talk Olivia Newton-John. Perth turned pink overnight.
Yeah, we had Optus Stadium and Matagurrup Bridge glow pink in honour of Australia's sweetheart, Premier Mark McGowan. Issued a post on Facebook supporting her family with a photograph of the icons lit up. Similar thing happened in Melbourne overnight, Rod Laver Arena, Flinders Street Station, parts of the CityLink Freeway, all glowing pink. Sydney, strangely, has now caught on to it, and I think tonight they're going to be lighting up the Opera House, not the Optus House. That would be a completely different thing. The Opera House in pink. So a little bit later in Sydney, but at least us and Melbourne were onto it.
But you know what I just want to talk about here? Like Olivia Newton-John, we love her so much, and Grease is one of her greatest roles. But so many people would have been watching Grease last night. Maybe a lot of younger people who are like, oh, I'm going to watch Grease. And I think, especially if you watched it with young kids, you would probably be shocked at how poorly some of Grease has aged. And we found this a couple of years ago when it aired on BBC One after a long absence. There was a huge outpouring of criticism for the film because it is misogynist, it is sexist. There are bits that are decidedly rapey. There's even one bit where John Travolta's Danny throws sand at Sandy's face on the beach, which, you know what, is actually a criminal offence in the state of California where it was filmed. There Rizzo is slut-shamed. Sandy is virgin-shamed.
Oh, my God.
It is a deeply problematic...
I wasn't prepared for this.
It's a deeply problematic film by today's standards.
What about the music?
Music's great.
Yeah.
Although some of that is also not good. There's mansplaining. There's more sexism. There's, you know, just flat-out misogyny in the songs. The Grease Lightning is referred to as a pussy wagon. And so I think some of that stuff is...
Isn't it good, though, that we have matured to this point?
Yeah, well, Olivia Newton-John defended it. She came out and defended it.
Well,
she always defended the film.
You kind of have to remember it's for its time.
Yeah.
In the 1950s. Isn't it great that we've moved on to where we are now?
That's the argument, right? That's the argument that you
watch. So are you wanting it to be cancelled?
A lot of people called for it to be cancelled when it aired on the BBC One.
Do you think it should be gone?
Oh, look, I think it should be aired maybe with a trigger warning and with, if you're going to watch it with kids, have a discussion with them about why it's not appropriate anymore. Did she put up a fight? Come on, give me a break.
Maddie, you've got a point.
Thanks for joining us in the studio.
It's a bit too soon. Maybe bring it up next week.
Okay. But yeah. Right. Olivia, we love you, though. We still love you. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Have a good one, mate.
You're listening to The West Live.
Now, there's been some shocking news this morning that one of WA's top doctors has been charged over a serious domestic violence attack. The West's crime editor, Shannon Hampton, joins us now to take us through this concerning story. Good morning, Shannon.
Good morning, Ben.
And so there is a suppression order on this case. What do we know and what can we talk about at the moment?
Yes, so we can't say too much at this stage, but what we can say is that the doctor who has a suppression order on his identity has been charged with assaulting his wife in April. And he is facing a very serious charge of aggravated assault occasioning bodily harm, which alleges, that charge alleges that there has been an injury and it's aggravated because it's allegedly happened in a domestic setting. And he has pleaded not guilty. And in terms of the suppression order, there's a hearing today to determine whether that is to stay in place or whether the court will lift that, which will allow the press to freely report who this person is.
Mm. And so the accused was in Fremantle Magistrates Court on Monday, and I understand that his wife was also in court for the appearance.
Yeah, that's right. So she was there, and I understand it was quite a traumatic process for her, but she wanted to be there to see the first appearance of this alleged attacker.
Mm. And so, just for people who don't really understand the suppression process, and it might seem that, you know, the court is protecting someone who's been accused of a crime. Can you explain to us how it works and what is the reason behind it?
Yes, yeah, so a suppression order can protect certain things, so somebody's identity or a certain detail that has come out in court or is a part of the case, and a judge or magistrate makes the suppression order, they have to decide that it is in the interest of justice to do so. And there's a very high bar because our court process is a open process, and it needs to justice needs to be seen to be done. But there are certain situations where a suppression order is deemed necessary, and that can be to protect the identity of somebody, such as a victim of a serious crime or a rollover witness who may, be in serious danger if their identity is in the public realm. And it can also protect the public from hearing certain information with a trial coming up, such as the person's past criminal history. In this case, it is protecting the accused's identity, but the suppression order is only in place on an interim basis, and that's to allow interested parties such as the media to have the opportunity to make arguments as to why it should be lifted.
Mm.
So that's why we've had a couple of days for our lawyers to have a look into the case and to whether it's worth us sort of fighting. And it also gives the magistrate a better opportunity, because it's a busy court with hundreds of cases going through that, to properly consider the matter.
Yeah, right. So it's kind of like, I guess, a cautious approach by the magistrate in this case, because you're dealing with an accused, a doctor who has plenty of experience, holds an influential position in the health sector. And so just out of an abundance of caution, they've gone, we're going to slap a suppression order on this, but then they're going to come back and revisit that today. Seven West Media, which of course publishes The West Australian and The West Live, is contesting that suppression order. So do you think there's a chance that whether it remains in place or is lifted will be found out today?
Yeah, that should be determined today for sure, because there's a special hearing especially for that. But I mean, yeah, it is court, and sometimes things don't roll happen the way we think. So yeah, we'll just have to wait and see. But it is due to be heard this morning.
Yeah, we'll wait to see if we learn any more today about this disturbing case. The West crime editor, Shannon Hampton, thanks for joining us on The West Live.
No worries, thank you.
You might remember yesterday on the show, we spoke to the Kalgoorlie Miner's deputy editor, Amber Lilly, who told her story about being sexually harassed and groped at the Diggers and Dealers Mining Conference in the Goldfields town. After that, we were approached by Crime Stoppers WA, who listened to Amber's story and brought to our attention some stats and a new platform that could help victims of these sorts of incidents who might be too scared to speak in person. Now, I recommend you do listen to Amber's story, and you can find that on the West Live podcast, titled I Was Groped at Diggers, a journo recounts the incident. But now we're joined by the CEO of Crime Stoppers in WA, Vince Hughes. Good morning, Vince.
Good morning. How you doing, Ben? Everything going well?
Yeah, going really well. And so you got in touch after hearing our interview with Amber. What jumped out at you about her story?
Well, what jumped out at me about the story was, and not just Amber's story, but all those similar stories that have been going around very, very recently, is that people knew these things happen, and people know the people who are perpetrators of this type of behavior. But for some reason, people don't make the reports. And I'm saying male females don't make the reports. Companies are really, I suppose, a bit remiss in thinking that the systems that they actually have in place work. If this is happening on a regular basis and it's happening so often, well, then the question is to say, well, why? And do the systems we have work? And we, air research at Crime Stoppers, will tell you that it doesn't work. And it doesn't work for one reason, and that is that most organizations say they offer anonymous reporting systems, when in fact, at best, they offer confidential reporting systems. And there is a difference between the two concepts. Anonymous means you don't know who I am, and I'm not going to find out. And confidential means I know who you are, and I might release your details if I have to. Mm. And therein lies the big difference between the reporting systems.
And so if from what you've learned, how does that impact a victim's motivation in coming forward?
Well, it makes it very, very easy to come forward, because a lot of people, and we have people from emerging communities, we have people from different cultural backgrounds who you know, we take the sexual situations where they may feel shamed by making the report. They may feel they've been disrespectful to the family as a result. So we've got those situations. Or we've got other situations where people just say, look, I'm not going to tell. I have a mortgage. I don't want to be victimized. I don't want to make any complaint here, and we'll accept it. Whereas the platform, it's safe to say, is it allows people to make the report. People have antecedents. We know that people have been charged with rape. Other men know their behaviors. Other men work with them on the mining sites. They boast, they talk to each other, they hear things. And all it takes is for one man even to make the report anonymously and say, look, you really need to be looking at, I'll use my name, you really need to be looking at Vince Hughes. This is the type of behavior this is the type of conversation that we hear in the crib room. You know, and it then, you know, but I'm not going to tell you who I am because I'm quite friendly with him, you know, or he's my boss or whatever. But here's the situation, and I really leave it up to you as an organization to deal with it. Mm. Now, if a few people were to do that, that raises a hair for an organization. It's a red alert, and an organization can then start to do something about it.
Yeah, well, I think it's such an important thing that you're talking about here. So this Safe to Say platform that has been developed by Crime Stoppers so that women or people who witness any kind of bullying or intimidation or sexual harassment can make anonymous reports, what you touched on there, I think, though, is fascinating, that, you know, it might not necessarily just be victims who obviously, you know, this is very valuable to them to have a safe space where they can make a report. But to blokes who might traditionally have thought, well, you know what, I've seen some behaviour here that I really know is not okay, but I don't necessarily want to put myself into the middle of a workplace issue over it. But now they can do it anonymously. And tell me, like, how much has what we've seen in the resource sector that's played out so publicly over the last 12 months because of reporting by my colleague Caitlin Rintoul in The West Australian played into the development of Safe to Say?
Look, I suppose if we go back to the history of Crime Stoppers, Crime Stoppers has been working across Australia for about 30 years now. And it's a not-for-profit organisation who offers anonymous reporting for police. So police many, many years ago realised that members of the public didn't really have 100% trust in reporting directly to police for the same reasons I've outlined. And what they did was they took an arm's length approach in relation to reporting, and they went into partnership with Crime Stoppers. What we're doing now is taking the same technology, but a more sophisticated version of it, and moving it into the private industry and saying, look, it's worked for 30 years with police, and surely it's going to work with you as well. Now, what we have in this system is a two-way anonymous reporting. In other words, that if a person makes a report, the person receiving the report at the organization can leave a message for the person who made the report and say, thank you very much for your report. We really appreciate this type of information. Can you clarify X, Y, and Z? Or thank you very much for this report. However, we feel your report should be best made to here or somewhere else. So that conversation goes on anonymously. And when we find that this goes on, the people who make the report originally, many of them actually come forward and say, look, I'm prepared under certain circumstances to say who I am and to come forward and have a conversation.
Mm. And so in the case of Crime Stoppers, the reports are made to the police when there's a crime. In the case of Safe to Say, so the anonymous reports that are lodged on the platform go to companies involved, is that correct?
Yes, it goes to the organisation itself.
Yeah,
yes.
Right. And so then does it also go to the police?
Not necessarily. Like, it may not. It may only be circumstantial, I suppose. The report may only have circumstantial data in it. So it might be Vince Hughes, his language is not great, and we believe this could be the case. So, no, but there is a known as on the organisation. Mm. If they get matters of a criminal, then they would have to report that to police. And likewise, if government agencies take it on as well, which some are very interested at the moment, they still have their obligations under the CCC Act and to make sure that they report to the CCC any corruption or any serious misconduct or to the Public Sector Commissioner for minor misconduct.
And so do businesses have to subscribe to this platform? How does it work?
Well, look, it's a license that they take out. It's a $6,000 license every year. It's as cheap as chips, we say here. And the reason we've made it so cheap is that organizations will actually use it. We have to actually put it on a platform. We have to develop it, and we have to make sure that the cybersecurity around it is bang on. So that's the cost we charge to an organization. We don't make a profit on it, and any additional profit we would make will go back into community projects.
Mm. And can you give us an idea of the uptake of the service so far?
Well, look, I suppose I'm not going to use the organizations have never given me permission to say that they're using it or not, but I can say that there are five mining organizations using, well, four mining organizations and a traffic management who has allowed me to say yes, and that's Warp Traffic Management Unit. I've just taken her out there, our traffic management, WARP. Look, we like to say that's five organizations who have now become Safe to Say, and we'd like to ask other organizations, why don't you become Safe to Say?
Mm, I think it makes a lot of sense. And so what can businesses do, and also more importantly, what can people do in terms of finding this platform and using it?
It's very, very simple. You just contact, we have a website called Safe to Say website. You can leave your details on that site, contact us that way, or just contact Crime Stoppers directly, and we will we will deal with it. With that also, you get IT support and legal advice to go with that cost as well. So really, the package is so cheap that I couldn't see why people would not be using it. It seems to be, people say, well, we already have a system in place. But I'd ask leaders in particular to say, is my system working? And then my system is, do I have a complete anonymous system? And likewise, when organizations outsource their reporting as well, they're outsourcing it to a third party who gets the information about their organization first. Now, if I was a leader in any organization, I would prefer to get the information first. I would prefer first to know what crisis I may be coming ahead of me. Yeah. Before another organization knows first, even though they're packaging it and sending it to me. But those organizations know your business.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. And if we've learnt anything over the past 12 months, there's still so much work to be done in this space. This is a great initiative to tackle what has become a real scourge in workplaces in Western Australia. Crime Stoppers WA CEO Vince Hughes, thanks so much for joining us on the
West Live. Thanks, Ben. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
And we'll put a link to Amber's story in the show notes.
You're listening to The West Live.
Is COVID over? That's the suggestion that's going around Australia at the moment, especially here in WA, after the state government announced hospitals would be winding back their COVID protocols. So are we really at the end of the pandemic? Joining us now to help us figure that out is the head of epidemiological modelling at Monash University, Professor James Trower. G'day, James. Welcome back to the show.
Morning, Ben.
Okay, so there are people still testing positive to COVID. So obviously it's not over, but are we seeing the pandemic peter out in Australia right now?
It's hard to say. I mean, it is dependent upon whether we get future variants, new variants emerging overseas or anywhere. And I guess we won't know for a while. But at this stage, there's nothing overseas waiting to sort of jump into Australia that's really concerning. So I'm pretty positive about at least the next few months. And all of the variants that we've had emerging, there is some cross immunity too. So hopefully it's a much more positive outlook than what we've had previously.
That sounds like pretty good news. And what we're seeing over on this side of the country is that the expected second wave of Omicron, fueled by the BA4 and BA5 subvariants, didn't really eventuate. What do you think's going on there?
Well, even in WA, there's been a significant number of hospitalizations. And I feel like the WA epidemic, it's earlier in the year, was very, very different from the other states. But it's now beginning to track a little bit more with the other states. And partly that's because WA is now more connected to the rest of Australia than what it has been. So I think we're seeing some pretty rapid drops in a lot of states across Australia. And case numbers, we saw that signal first, as you always do. And then hospitalizations are beginning to follow that. So I think, I think we're seeing that overseas as well. So hopefully it's looking positive for WA as well, that we'll continue to see hospitalisation numbers fall.
And of course, one of the aspects of this is that people suggesting that some of that drop in case numbers could be just general fatigue in the community, not getting tested. I guess, is there any way to say for sure that the numbers that we're seeing are accurate reflections of what is actually out there in terms of where the virus is?
I think you can look at the trends. I think they're still very valid because, sure, people are getting tested a bit less, but why would there be, significantly fewer? Across Australia, there's maybe like 20, 40% fewer cases this week than for the same time last week. So we're clearly seeing a change. And I don't think people have changed their testing behaviours that dramatically in the last week. So I think you can look at these trends and things are clearly heading downwards at the moment.
And I spoke to the head of the GP Council at the AMA in Western Australia the other day, and he said anecdotally, doctors were not seeing the COVID reinfection happening at a rate that authorities were expecting. Did we overestimate the risk of that?
Well, yeah, and I guess that might be part of what's going on in WA as well, that you've had a more recent large BA2 epidemic, and then that actually has provided some immunity against the BA5 epidemic that's going through at the moment and is hopefully finishing up. So, there's always different data sources. We look at these cross-reacting antibodies studies, and that's what we base a lot of our knowledge on. But they're laboratory studies, and the real world is the real test, I suppose. And so I think we are seeing significant cross immunity between these different subvariants.
Yeah, and do you think there'll be a moment or a statistic that we can point to at some moment in the next couple of months where you could definitively say, okay, this pandemic is done?
I don't think so, because I think we will get future waves. Like, even if we don't see future variants emerge and nasty variants come up in the next, you know, months or years or something, I think we will still get future waves, because I think immunity does wane and it's not perfect. So we will always, I think, be facing some sort of cyclical pattern of COVID. But if people have been infected multiple times, they've had multiple vaccines, then they'll be relatively protected. I think we'll still have to look at protecting elderly people against these recurrent waves. So I would not say it's over. But hopefully we've seen the end of lockdowns and things like that.
Mm. And looking at the Birmingham Commonwealth Games, there was this incredible scene in the women's T20 where one of the players in the Australian team that went on to win the gold medal actually had tested positive the day of the match and played under the restrictions, or rather lack thereof, in the UK at the moment. Well, is that what we'll see eventually in Australia, where even if you have COVID, it'll just be kind of, you know, play on?
I think eventually we should. I mean, I guess we've got other coronaviruses that circulate all the time, and we just think of them as the common cold. So we deal with them in the same way as we would for the common cold. I mean, well, I don't think we're quite there yet, because we've got hospitals that are significantly stretched with COVID patients. So that's something for maybe a year or two from now. But and also the UK are sort of further down that track than what we are. You know, they started off with their big transmission waves much earlier than we did. So they're sort of ahead of us on that. But I think that is, that is where we're heading.
Mm. And now let's talk about new viruses. Monkeypox was kind of the first one that emerged after COVID-19. But now there's a virus in China that people are talking about, the Langya virus, that's infected 35 people. What do we know about that at the moment?
Yeah, well, it's from this. I don't know whether anybody remembers Hendra virus.
Yes.
It was in the news a bit a few years ago, and there were deaths in Australia. It's closely related to, well, it's in the same family as that sort of virus, but it doesn't at this stage look as if it's established human-to-human transmission from what I can see. I mean, that's what the China CDC, I think, are still reporting, unless there's been anything come through very recently. So at this stage, it looks like it's one of those viruses that is sort of just making individual jumps from animals to humans, and it doesn't transmit efficiently enough within humans to sustain transmission. We don't know exactly what the animal reservoir is, where the sort of virus lives. It might be some sort of Chinese shrew, but we're not really sure. So I don't think we need to panic yet, but I guess we do need to keep close eye on it.
Mm. And just on that topic, just sort of speaking broadly, after the COVID-19 experience coming out of Wuhan, like, are authorities around the world keeping a closer eye on China?
I mean, there's been all of these different viruses emerge. Of course, you know, monkeypox came from West Africa, and we've had, we had 2009 flu come from Mexico, and so we just have a very big global interconnected world, and there's a lot of people in China. There's a lot of different species of animals living in close proximity to people, but that's the case for a lot of developing countries around the world. So I think we do need more robust systems globally to identify these threats early and respond early, and maybe there's been a little bit of a move in that direction since the pandemic. I'm not sure it's been enough, really.
Yeah, well, hopefully that move continues happening, because we certainly don't need another COVID-19. Head of Epidemiological Modelling at Monash University, Professor James Trower, thanks for joining us on The West Live.
Thanks, Ben.
Qantas has announced increased transit times for Sydney and Melbourne airports to combat lost baggage. The West Australian's aviation expert, Geoffrey Thomas, joins us now to explain. Good morning, GT.
Hey, Ben. How are you?
Good. So tell us what's going on here. Is this a sort of an acknowledgement that the baggage situation in airports is getting to a pretty critical point?
Oh, look, absolutely. I mean, we know there are staff shortages. That's the that's a global problem, right? Right across the aviation industry, top to bottom, whether it's airlines, airports, suppliers to airlines, whatever. You've got a staff shortage, and then you've got COVID illness as well. Because don't forget, COVID's still out there in the community. Absenteeism up to 30% in some areas through to COVID illness. So that's absolutely a major problem. So to try and, you know, ease the problem and try and have more resources, they're pushing back the transit time from 60 minutes to 90 minutes. I mean, you know, normally people sort of say, yeah, great, I want to get off one flight. I want to get onto my next one. I want a tight connection. People normally want a tight connection. They don't want to hang around at a terminal or you know, in transit. So, you know, airlines over the years have responded to that by cutting the transit times. Now they've had to push it back to what it used to be 20 years ago, 90 minutes. So it eases the pressure. And at the moment, there's about 9 passengers per 1,000 who are being divorced from their bags. The pre-COVID rate was about 5 per 1,000 passengers who were missing their bags. So Qantas is striving to get it back to at least 5, if not better it. And the major problem areas have been Melbourne and Sydney airports with lost baggage between international and domestic, or domestic and international.
And so this is going to impact some Perth travellers who are flying into Sydney and Melbourne to catch connecting international flights. And so what happens to people who already have their flights booked?
Well, look, Qantas is getting in touch with everybody who is impacted by this, and they're putting them on an earlier flight. That's been done, has been done over the last 24 hours. So, you know, it's just a matter of, instead of taking the 9 o'clock to Sydney, you've got to take the 7 o'clock to Sydney, and you're going to have possibly not 90 minutes, but you may have 2 hours of transit time. But, you know, I think I'd rather have a longer transit time and have my bag arrive in LA than not, because, you know, if it doesn't arrive in LA on that day, you're off on a you're hiring a car and you're driving off somewhere, it's a major, major headache. So, yeah, it's a good strategy, and I think that 90 minutes may remain, because I personally think 60 minutes is too tight, particularly at Sydney, where they've got to take the bags from one side of the airport to the other. I think 60 minutes myself is a too tight connection. And I typically, when I go to the States through Sydney, I try and take one bag, which is what I carry on with, and try and work from just one bag, because I don't trust the baggage transfer.
Yeah, I tell you what, a lot of young people travelling to the States who need outfits for LA, outfits for Vegas, outfits for New York might struggle with only one carry-on bag, GT. But I'm with you. I'm with you 100% on that transit times. Like, I actually get quite stressed out on a very fast transit between connections at international airports. And maybe it's growing up in the Northern Territory, where flying down to my home state of Brisbane every school holidays, you'd kind of have a stopover in Cairns that would be, you know, maybe four to 6 hours, and give you time to go into Cairns, have a bit of a look around. But I like it. I like having 90 minutes or even a little bit more in an airport, have a bit of a wander about, check the place out, maybe hit up a Burger King or a Hungry Jack's or a Macca's, and avail myself of the whatever junk food options there are in the terminal. I feel like it's a guilty pleasure of travelling.
Absolutely. I mean, airport terminals are actually great places. Just if you go out and explore, there's all sorts of neat things to do, books to look at, you know, magazines to look at, catch a coffee or get a nice wine or something like that, or a good beer. Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, when it comes to traveling, you know, next time the listeners travel, you know, when you pack your bag, you've got all these different jumpers, all these different coats and shirts and whatever else. Then think about your trip. Look at your photos of your trip and see how many variations you actually wore. Mm. You probably lived in the same clothes, more or less, all the way through the trip. So I think a little bit of lean travelling is in order.
It's not bad advice at all. And now the other interesting thing that you're reporting on today is that Qantas is cutting back on more flights on top of the 10% that it had already announced. And so is that in relation to some of the stuff that you've already spoken about on the show today, the sick leave because of COVID and that sort of stuff?
Yes, look, at the moment, the airline's got limited resources with piloting and crew and ground people. And they had, you know, obviously with the demand, they had pushed the system to the limit, and now they're pulling it back and saying, look, okay, we're just not going to have that many flights because we need more people in reserve. That's what they need, more people in reserve to fill in when people are sick with COVID. And that's been their big problem, is that, you know, we all of us are guilty of this. We don't have to wear a mask. We can go overseas. We can travel where we like. The state borders are down. COVID's over. Well, COVID is not over, and people are still dying. People are still getting sick, etc., etc. So we have to be, you know, aware of that fact. You know, and so the airlines have got to have more folks in reserve to fill those gaps. And I think one other message that's really, really important right now is a lot of people, a lot of staff, airline staff and travel agents as well, are calling in sick because they're so stressed. Mm. You know, sure, passengers are stressed. But just imagine having somebody barking at you all day long, or different people barking at you all day long, complaining about this, that and the other. Sure, the complaints are genuine, and there's no question about that. But the effect on the staff, they're exhausted, they're shattered, and some of them are having breakdowns. And this is also causing a problem because, you know, when they take stress leave or they call in sick with COVID, but they're not, they're just stressed out of their minds, that's making the whole situation a lot worse. So I think passengers, you know, this is a very stressful time. Passengers have absolutely got to understand we're all under stress. Everybody's under stress. And just, okay, chill out. You know, it's going to take you 2 hours to get through that queue, or an hour and a half or whatever, twice what it used to be. Just chill out.
Yeah.
Just chill out.
And give the airline staff a break. And just think back to the past couple of years where we've been trapped in Fortress WA and couldn't go anywhere, and how lucky we are that now international travel has resumed. Before we let you go, all of this stuff that we're talking about today, does that help explain why we're not seeing a lot of amazing deals on airfares at the moment?
Look, absolutely. You know, we're not seeing too many fare sales at the moment, and for a very, very good reason, because the airlines are full. Seats are hard to come by. However, having said that, if you were prepared, as I did the other day, to have a look at Perth Broome, because I'm going up to Broome in July next year, wow, $189 one way. Fantastic. Yeah, it was great. Red E deal, you know. So, you know, July next year. So if you're prepared to book far enough ahead, if you can plan your life far enough ahead, and I know most people plan a day ahead these days, but if you're prepared to book ahead, there's some terrific deals out there, absolutely, but they're way off in the future. The deals are still there. They're just not there, you know, for the next couple of months.
Well, GT, next the middle of next year, when you're pulling up on that banana lounge at the Cable Beach Resort, having a mango daiquiri, don't be surprised if you see me lying there next year.
Yeah, well, Christ, I might cancel now.
The West's aviation expert, Geoffrey Thomas, thanks for joining us on The West Live.
Pleasure.
Tonight, 7:30, MKR is just heating up.
Delicious.
Exquisite.
As Nigella and Manu travel Australia looking for our best home cooking.
That was everything I hoped it would be and more.
I think it's a bloody ripper.
The love is back.
My score is 10.
Is it 10?
Can't stop smiling.
The all-new MKR. Tonight, 7:30 on 7 and 7 Plus.
Wild West.
Joining me now in the studio is Westlife producer Kate Ryan. G'day, Kate.
Good morning.
How you doing?
Yeah, pretty good.
Been
for
a busy morning.
Wednesday, yeah.
Yeah, been very busy, very busy. Well, let's jump straight in and talk about Tash Peterson. She once upon a time was WA's most prominent vegan. She's someone else's problem now.
Yep.
She's gone over.
And she's not the most prominent vegan in Melbourne. So.
No, there's a few prominent vegans over there. Mm-hmm. But she didn't waste any time after arriving in Melbourne. She hit the streets clad in not very much to protest animal rights. Good on her. That's her right to do it. But in response, you know, she always cops a lot of criticism, and some of it is you know, it's not about her politics. It's not about her protest activities. Mm. It's personal attacks about her body, which, yeah. And now she has hit back at those comments.
Yeah. So she's posted on her Instagram, which I find really weird, not in that she's posting about it. She just says, the amount of disgusting messages and comments I've received about these images. So it's her in like lingerie, as you said. She tries to share them, but they just keep getting taken down. So what, it's okay for someone to personally attack her and send her messages, but when she tries to call them out and put it on her stories, they keep getting taken down?
Yeah, weird.
Anyway, she just said she's received comments saying that she had a penis, it looked like she was in drag, she was ugly, no shape, that kind of stuff. But you know what? She's hit back and said, To that, I say thank you. Keep being obsessed. These words aren't even insults to me, but can be hurtful to other people.
Yeah.
So she's like, yeah, keep following me. Keep watching me. So
yeah, sticks and stones, yep. Basically.
Yeah.
So, I think the issue here is, you know, people are making these comments in the comments section of her post, or maybe is, you know, sort of sliding into her DMs and saying it. And then she has kind of like screen grabbed it and gone to post it. And then those posts are the things that have been blocked by Instagram's algorithm. But, you know, if I was Tash Peterson, so she, of course, as she talks about in the media often, is that, you know, she's on OnlyFans. She uses OnlyFans to, I guess, pay for her ability to be a professional activist, which again, there's nothing illegal about that. And so if I was her, like she said, she once said that she makes $40,000 a month on OnlyFans. Mm. So, and that's people who are literally paying to see her body. So, you know, no wonder she's feeling pretty positive about it. And she doesn't let the comments of a few idiots get her down because, you know, she's got 40,000 reasons
laughing.
A month to think that maybe there's nothing at all wrong with her body.
Yeah. So, and this all came about because, she was able to protest at the Bourke Street Mall with her fellow activist and a body positive model, Stefania Ferrario.
Well, I think my thing with Tash is always, you know, like she has every right to have the opinion that she does. I think it's a valuable conversation to start around animal rights and how animals are treated in the food production business. But, you know, there's limits as well. You're like, don't go screaming at kids at a child's birthday party and things
calling
like that.
Calling people murderers. I think when she says that people who eat meat are murderers, also kind of, I can't think of it, trivializes the actual murder.
So she doesn't always get it right, but she certainly makes life more interesting.
Yeah.
And now let's talk about Starburst, beloved lolly.
Yes.
There's some bad news for fans of this particular confectionery.
So people have noticed that they have just mysteriously disappeared from shelves all over Australia. And someone has taken to TikTok with a conspiracy theory that they've just stopped making them or stopped selling them, and no one's realised they've just quietly. So this is Mars Wrigley, who make Starburst, that they've just quietly taken them away and nobody's noticed, which I suppose is the, like, if you can't find it and they've quietly taken it away instead of making a big announcement, then really they've done a good job. But apparently it's happened since June. They've been not on the shelves.
I like that this person has gone to supermarkets and shops. They've travelled all around trying to find them, and then has gone, do you know what? There's something going on here.
There's a conspiracy.
And so, interestingly, so a spokesperson for Mars Wrigley that manufactures Starburst has told 7 News that there's a reason that they're so hard to find, and that's because, the brand has been discontinued. They say they review the product range to ensure that we're offering our customers great-tasting products and also great value for money. Our Starburst products are imported from Europe, and like many businesses that are importing products from overseas, the brand has been exposed to supply chain difficulties and rising cost pressures over the last 2 years. And so they said, reviewing all the options, there was just no way to make it cost-effective and available regularly to consumers here in WA, so they're like, do you know what? We're just going to pull it.
What was your favourite Starburst flavour?
Oh, let's see. I would say, I'm trying to remember what the flavours were. Cherry, I think, was my least favourite. I thought, I didn't like cherry at all. You like cherry?
Yeah.
I just thought it was like a bit aniseedy or something.
No, I liked it. It's like what you get in an amaretto sour now.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think strawberry probably. I love fake strawberry flavour.
I didn't mind the green because it was apple and not lime.
That was nice. And lemon. How tart was that lemon?
Yeah.
And orange also not great. Now that I think about it, like three of the four flavours, I don't think I even liked.
No, and you always get stuck with them. They put like zero pink and red in there, and then you're stuck with all the green and orange.
It's so true. Or you share them around, and everyone takes the good ones, and then you're left with the duds.
Yeah.
And then they also did Starburst Snakes and Starburst Babies. Mm-hmm. But
you know, lollipops as well, apparently.
Yeah, I just don't think they could probably cut into, you know, the market share that Allen's had with their Snakes Alive and you know, whatever else, the little babies, whatever they are, what are they called? Jelly Babies? Is that what they're called?
Yeah.
And then, of course, the Natural Confectionery Company. So pretty much everybody made better things than Starburst. So that's probably it. But unfortunately for that one TikToker who was the last person still who cared about Starburst, bad news for them.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Bad news for my mum.
Because she's a Starburst fan.
She is. It's like if she goes on a plane, that is her, like, she beelines for the news agency. Wow. She doesn't even buy it beforehand. Goes to the airport news agency, buys a Starburst, and then that's her treat.
That's her treat for the plane.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
It also helps with your popping ears.
It does. I use chewing gum for that.
Yeah.
And now let's talk about Anne Heche, the actress, former partner of Ellen DeGeneres, who has been involved in a fiery car accident, which really shocked Hollywood earlier this week. And now we have an update on her medical condition.
Yeah. So it looks like she's been in a coma since pretty much just after the accident. It was like a high speed crash and ended up with her crashing into a two-story building basically, and then the car burst into flames, and I think it's miraculous that she even survived that, but she's been slipping in and out of a coma. It was thought that she was stable on Saturday, but has since kind of gone into the critical stage. She had significant injury. She's got a lung injury, which looks like either something to do with an impact or inhaling smoke or whatever. So, yeah, she's doing better than what I guess they thought that she would be doing, but she's still very, very sick.
Yeah, gosh. It's certainly very, very serious injuries that she sustained. And now people are trying to still figure out how the accident happened.
They don't even know how it happened.
There's still a lot of unknowns around, you know, how such a serious accident took place and what was, you know, kind of her state of mind. Now they're sort of combing through her social media and seeing, you know, where she was earlier in the day. She posted a video and people are trying to unpack, you know, sort of, you know, how she was in that video.
She was in that
video.
Wig shop, though, as well.
That's right.
And then the owner of the wig shop said she was coherent, because some people are saying that she was drunk, and you know, she's been on podcasts previously saying that when she has bad days she, you know, downs a bottle of vodka, but this wig shop owner has said no, she was completely coherent hours before the crash. Or even, you know, not even hours, just an hour before the crash.
We'll have to wait and find out more, I guess,
into how it all transpired.
Yeah, sad. Yeah. Certainly sad, that's for sure. And now, this feud between Britney and her ex, her baby daddy, Kevin Federline, is really showing no signs of slowing down.
No. So this all started when Kevin Federline said that their two boys that they share together have decided they're not seeing Britney right now. And he went out and spoke out about it. Instead of, you know, keeping this in-house, he's gone public with it. He said it's been a few months since they've seen her. They made the decision not to go to the wedding. It's been tough. It's the most challenging thing that I've ever had to do in my life. So it was an interview that he did on TV.
Yeah.
So she's hit back and said, "It saddens me to hear that my ex-husband has decided to discuss the relationship between me and my children, as well as As we all know, raising teenage boys is never easy for anyone. It concerns me the fact that the reason is based on my Instagram. It was long before Instagram. I gave them everything, only one word, hurtful. My mother told me you should give them to their dad. I'm sharing this because I can."
Yeah, interesting. It's pretty grubby.
He also said something that, you know, Jamie Spears, you know, he protected her by this.
He basically said that the conservatorship wasn't such a bad idea. It's an interesting situation, right? Like, I think generally speaking, it's probably better that a person is not controlled by somebody else and have their assets and money and income and decisions and everything made for them by a third party. Britney has done plenty over the past 2 years that, you know, would probably make you have concerns for her mental state at times.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, when you're talking about a situation that's involving kids as well, I certainly don't think it helps the kids who are now old enough to be reading some of this stuff in the media to have their dad, K-Fed. Remember when he used to be getting, people used to call him K-Fed?
Yeah.
K-Fed going around, you know, kind of airing the dirty laundry. So, yeah, we'll wait and see what happens. Just another sad chapter in Britney Spears' life.
Yeah, I suppose as well. And Sam Asghari, Britney's new husband, also posted on Instagram with a big long rant on his Instagram as well, saying that, to clarify, my wife has never posted a nude selfie except of her butt, which is quite modest these days. All other posts were implied nudity, which can be in any lotion mate. For soap.
Like, mate, it's like, come on. Like, let's just call a spade a spade. She's posted many, many naked selfies.
Yeah.
And bits have been covered up, but that's only because they wouldn't have been allowed on. They wouldn't have been allowed on Instagram otherwise.
Yeah. And, you know, I can see from her side, she's been held back ever since, and she's like, I'm getting control of my body. Yeah. I mean, seeing it every day is a little bit like,
maybe a little bit over
but,
the top.
You know, also all power to her.
Yeah.
And if she's having an issue with her children, keep it between yourselves. Yeah. I don't want to hear it.
It's not good for anybody.
No. And especially for the boys, like, they're teenagers, and they... We don't know what they think about it.
Yeah, it's bad. Definitely bad for them. Yep. And now let's talk about Kim Kardashian and Pete Davidson, the world's most fascinating celebrity couple who split in the last week. And now, you know, as you'd expect in the wake of one of these very high profile splits, a bit more dirt is coming out. But this one, I didn't see this one coming.
Yeah, so there are rumours that before their split, Pete Davidson had proposed to Kim and that it went the opposite way that he had.
What a loser.
So we all know, if we follow Pete Davidson's life, as you know, it's more against our will than what we actually want. But he proposed to Ariana Grande within weeks of dating. So we know that he falls hard and he falls fast. But, you know, I think dating someone almost 20 years your senior who is, you know, quite independent, I think maybe that probably was the immaturity that came out.
I think that would have been a huge red flag.
If that is true,
for Kim, don't you reckon?
Yeah.
It's like, I'm just having a bit of fun after getting out of this lengthy relationship that ended up ending very badly with Kanye West. Just having a bit of fun.
And then
the new bloke after like a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, babe, what do you reckon?
Yeah. And why would you think, as Pete Davidson, that this is the solution?
Yeah.
Like going, oh, I know what she would like, to be married again.
Yeah.
No, she probably just wants to be on her own. But apparently, because of, like, following the breakup, Kanye has posted, like, some really, like, bad Instagram posts about Pete Davidson, saying, like, R.A.P. Pete and all that kind of stuff. He just hates him. Anyway. Yeah. Pete is in trauma therapy because of it.
Well, I do feel a bit bad for Pete, especially if, you know, he is sincerely...
Yes,
you
Pete Davidson dead at age 28. That's,
Kanye. He doesn't make things any easier, that's for sure. But you have to feel for Pete. So if Pete Davidson has actually legitimately fell so hard for Kim Kardashian, and why wouldn't you? You know, amazing entrepreneur, not bad on the eye, in kind of by any measure, quite a catch. For someone like Pete, and so he's fallen for her. Maybe he's got down on one knee. Maybe he's had some whole big proposal thing.
Yeah.
Who knows? And then she's knocked him back. And not only that, that's been the deal breaker for her to go, you know what? You're not the dude for me after all.
But apparently there's more rumours. So these are all just rumours at the moment that it simply just wound down as well. So it's either blown up spectacularly with a rejected proposal, or it just fizzled out.
And look, I think, you know, like, I think there's a bit of truth to all of that, right? Like, I think I think he probably got a lot more than he bargained for when it comes to being kind of like brought into the Kardashian craziness.
Yeah.
And the level of media scrutiny and everything that he did, like, he never struck me as the sort of dude who would love that kind of attention. And so, I just hope now that they both go on their merry ways. Kanye shuts up, basically. We don't need to hear anything more from him.
Especially because Kanye is like, he's obviously, he knows that Pete Davidson has had mental health issues in the past. And,
Kanye. He's just butthurt over the whole thing. So he just needs to shut up. And now let's talk about Gabby Petito. This is something that we've spoken about on the show, not for quite a while, but it certainly was a mystery that fascinated the world for weeks at a time.
Yeah. So for those of you who don't remember, Gabby Petito, she was the woman who was murdered, which I think police say now that happened, by her boyfriend Brian Laundrie, while they were on holiday in America. Her body was found a couple of weeks after she went missing, and then a few weeks after that, after a whole load of searches, but then also Brian's family not talking and I guess sightings of Brian at their house, but then they said that he wasn't there. Anyway, his body was found later in the desert as well. So now Gabby Petito's family, a couple of months after all of this has happened, has announced that they are suing the police for Australian $71 million for wrongful death against Utah police. And they allege that the police failed to recognise that their daughter was in a life-threatening situation last year when officers investigated a fight between her and her boyfriend. So this was one of the other things, that there was a video that came out and it showed, it was like a body-worn camera, and it showed her actually quite shaken, but they found that she was the aggressor in that.
The cops took a very interesting reading on that. And so that's now why the family's suing the Utah police for $50 million US dollars over wrongful death. But you know what the thing that's interesting to me about this story now is, so have you had a chance to watch the show on Disney Plus, Under the Banner of Heaven?
No.
Starring Andrew Garfield, based on a true story, a double murder that happened in Utah back in the 80s, I believe. And what it really does is unpack the role of the Mormon religion in this particular crime, right?
Wow.
And because it was a woman and a baby that were murdered, and how in the Mormon religion, they are so heavily skewed towards believing that the man is what they call the priesthood holder of the household, and is basically the ultimate law in every household. So you have to do what the man says. And so I think it's very interesting that Utah police, of all police, and Utah is a state that, you know, more than 70% of people in Utah identify as Mormon, and 90% of the people who believe in God are Mormon. So it's like the vast majority of religious people in Utah are Mormon. You know, that they would take that bizarre reading that anyone else who watches the video thinks is completely bonkers, of thinking that she is the aggressor.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, you can put two and two together there. So the police have 60 days to respond before the family can actually file the suit, and a city spokesperson declined to comment on Monday.
I wonder if
they'll
just settle. Because that's what that time is for the sides to, you know, sort of to go through an arbitration process, and the cops say, well, here you go, here's $1 million, get lost.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll wait and see what happens there. More to come in the Gabby Petito sad, sad story. Mm-hmm. Kate Ryan, thank you for joining me in the studio today. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Well, that's it from me today. Thanks for your company, folks. I'll be back tomorrow live from 8:45 a.m. Don't forget to subscribe to The West Live on your favourite podcast player and give us a rating and a review, because it really helps us out.
You've been listening to The West Live with Ben O'Shea. If the story behind the story matters to you, then you can count on the west.com.au to deliver.